Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 863, titled 9/11, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Earth Island Boogie. This is being recorded on September 13th of the year 2015. 2 days ago, on Friday, September 11th of 2015, we recorded For the Record 862, talking about the 9/11 attacks, the Earth Island Boogie, and the Muslim Brotherhood. And in that, we spoke of a number of things. We spoke of the corporatist economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood and a comparison between the combat going on, or the combats going on in various places, between, among other elements, U.S. military forces and the Islamists that are being backed by transnationals, and also elements of our own fifth column-related intelligence elements. I compared that with the Second World War, a very real conflict in which American fighting forces were fighting and dying against the armies of fascism, which in turn, because of their corporatist and in some cases racist slash anti-Semitic philosophy, their eugenics philosophy, were viewed with favor by powerful transnational corporate elements in this country and others, and their associated political and national security forces. We read an article called The Politics of Three. That full annotation is in the description for the Record 862. And we noted that among the places where Islamist forces and Muslim Brotherhood forces were fighting with the support of Saudi Arabia and related, or allied, I should say, elements of Western intelligence, was in Chechnya and the Caucasus. We ended our discussion by noting something with which we are going to be resuming the discussion today, and that is the decampment of Chechen Islamist fighters who had been associated with ISIS in Syria to Ukraine. And that might seem like a very strange case of political bedfellows. Well, we're going to be looking at some very strange amalgamations of political bedfellows in this program. Remember the concept of the Earth Island, a gigantic stretch of land running from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, embracing most of the Middle East, the former Soviet Union, Russia, China, India. That stretch of land has been called by geopoliticians the Earth Island or the World Island. It embraces, it contains most of the world's landmass. It contains most of the world's population. It contains most of the world's natural resources, including and especially fossil fuels and oil. And last, but most assuredly not least, stretching right across the middle of that is a huge stretch of Muslim population. Bear in mind that in excess of 1 billion people adhere to the Muslim faith, more than a sixth of the world's population. And so when corporate interests look at the world as it is, they certainly want to bring corporatist economic philosophy to the Islamic world. Beyond that, we have been looking at Islam, or a manifestation of Islam that is not only corporatist along the lines of what the Muslim Brotherhood advocates and along the lines of what is viewed with great favor by transnational corporations, but the weaponized Islam that we spoke about with Peter Lavenda in our discussions with Peter about his remarkable recent book, The Hitler Legacy. Those are For the Record programs 8 38 through 847, a couple of which we will be excerpting in this program. We spoke about the use of weaponized religion as a way of recruiting or developing proxy warriors. Weaponized Islam and the corporatist Muslim Brotherhood agenda has been used in the Balkans. It was used against the former Soviet Union. It is almost certainly being used now in Chechnya. And although it would appear strange at first to see those fighters decamping from Syria to the Ukraine, it really isn't all that strange after all. We're going to be looking again at weaponized Islam. We're going to be looking at the pan-Turkist movement. We looked at that at great length and, for the record, 814, came back to it in 821, and other broadcasts, and in a number of, for the record, shows 721 and 723 among them. We looked at a growing confluence between the Islamist movement and the Muslim Brotherhood and the pan-Turkist movement, which seeks to unite Turkophone people, Turkic-speaking peoples, under the old banner of the Ottoman Empire. And Mr. Erdogan in Turkey has been promoting both Islamism of the Muslim Brotherhood type and a sort of neo-Ottoman agenda as well. We're going to be taking a look at a form of weaponized Buddhism as expressed by the Dalai Lama and Tibetan Buddhism, and we are going to be looking at weaponized Islam and Muslim proxy warriors aligned in some of the same configurations with weaponized Tibetan Buddhists and fighting as part of the same formations. Looming throughout this will be the Ukraine of the OUNB, the Ukrainian fascist elements whose heirs are in power in Ukraine today, and that were allied with the Third Reich, with the closely associated anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, and that also jumped to the CIA and other elements of Western intelligence at the end of World War II. I first came across those elements by studying their participation in the assassination of President Kennedy, and they will be looming large in the discussion today. Also, we're going to be taking a look at another element of commonality, which is the House of Habsburg, one of the generating forces for Ukrainian reaction, as we looked at in, for the record, 824 and again in, for the record, 833, was the Austro-Hungarian Empire of the Habsburgs and their Spring of Nations concept, in which various peoples within the Austro-Hungarian Empire were encouraged to embrace and manifest a militant and strident ethnic nationalism at the same time as that militant and strident ethnic nationalism was to be folded into a severe adherence to the Austro-Hungarian Empire itself. Karl von Habsburg is very active in the Ukraine today. His father, Otto von Habsburg, a member of the Free Rudolf Hess Society, was very close to Yaroslav Stetsko, head of the OUNB, head of the ABN, and the World War II leader of the Ukrainian puppet state of Nazi Germany, who pursued Nazi-style ethnic atrocities against Jews, ethnic Russians, Gypsies, Poles, and others during World War II. The UNPO is headed by Karl von Habsburg, and we're going to be taking a look at the UNPO, the Habsburgs, their alliance with the Dalai Lama, and also their alliance with a guy named Erin Altepkin. He is a pan-Turkist, a Uyghur, has associations with elements of Western intelligence, and is part of the Habsburg-dominated UNPO. And he is on the board of the Dalai Lama Foundation. And we're going to wrap up by taking a look at Paula Dobriansky, part of the OUNB milieu in this country. Her father, Lev Dobriansky, figures in the events surrounding the assassination of President Kennedy. He was Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas. He's passed away now, but he used to head the UCCA, the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America. That is the largest, basically, front group for the OUNB in the U.S. His daughter, Paula, was on Ronald Reagan's National Security Council, then became an Undersecretary of State under George W. Bush, where she ran the Tibet desk. So it is sort of full circle. We're going to be accessing material from past programs, and this, again, by way of understanding the admittedly very complex events which manifested themselves on September 11th, 2001, and that are continuing to do so. Now, once again, by the way, there was a reference that I misplaced in, For the Record, 862. It is now in the description for the Record, 862. It's called The Politics of Three and discusses Wahhabi and Muslim Brotherhood support for the Chechen guerrillas fighting in Russia in the Caucasus. Reviewing information that we have spoken about and that I have written about from Consortium News of July 7th of 2015, an article by Robert Perry, Ukraine Merges Nazis and Islamists. And this alludes this article, and again, I have read it into the record in part, and it is in the descriptions for several shows. Again, Chechen guerrillas have decamped from Syria and Chechnya to the Ukraine to fight against Russia. They are under the administrative command of Pravi Sektor, one of the one of the heirs to the OUNB. And as we noted in that article, skipping down, last September, Marcin, M-A-R-C-I-N, Mammon, M-A-M-O-N, a reporter for The Intercept, reached a vanguard group of these Islamic fighters in Ukraine through the help of his, quote, contact in Turkey with the Islamic State, who told me his brothers, unquote, were in Ukraine, and I could trust them, unquote. Where these Chechens, many of them anyway, appear to be coming from is Syria, where they have been fighting against the Assad regime, which is a Alawite and Shiite regime, Alawite and Shiite dominated regime in Syria. The Chechens appear to be Sunni and Muslim Brotherhood. ISIS appears to be an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. One of the things that prompted me to do this is there has been a lot of hot air being wafted about by the State Department and some de facto saber-rattling. Russia is building up its air forces in Syria, apparently to work on behalf of the Assad regime and against the Islamic State in Syria. The U.S. has been warning that that is not a good idea. I suspect that that is part of the proxy war that we spoke about in 862 with Russia, basically using Shia regimes and Shia forces in Iran, Syria, and elsewhere as proxy defensive warriors to guard their southern flank against the Sunni/Muslim Brotherhood corporatist elements that are being deployed in Chechnya and elsewhere.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
More on that, the Daily Beast of September 4th of 2015 has an article, Chechen Jihadists Join Ukraine's Fighters. It's by Anna Nemtsova, N-E-M-T-S-O-V-A. And in this article, it notes the following. The Daily Beast spoke with the Chechen militants about their possible support for the Islamic State and its affiliate in the Northern Caucasus region of Russia, which is now called the Islamic State Caucasus Emirate and is labeled a terrorist organization by both Russia and the United States. And it notes that some of them say they have trained, at least in the Middle East, with fighters for the so-called Islamic State or ISIS. And many of them have come from Syria. And so, again, when we see Russia building up its forces in Syria, I suspect that that is meant to counterbalance or negate the growing Sunni-slash-Muslim Brotherhood-slash-ISIS elements that are fighting in Ukraine and that have been fighting in Chechnya. Skipping down in this article. The Ukrainian government should be aware that Islamic radicals fight against democracy, says Varvara Pakomenko, an expert with at the International Crisis Group. Today, they unite with Ukrainian nationalists against Russians. Tomorrow, they will be fighting against liberals, unquote. Pakomenko says something similar happened in Georgia in 2012 when the government there found itself accused of cooperation with Islamic radicals from Europe, Chechnya, and the Pankizi Gorge, an ethnic Chechen region of Georgia. Something else that's interesting in this article, apparently, in addition to the near certainty that more Chechen Islamist battalions will be established to fight on behalf of the Ukrainian government, there is talk in Kiev of transferring Pravi Sektor into a special unit of the Ukrainian Intelligence Service, SBU, which is interesting in light of the fact that Pravi Sektor has already engaged in armed conflicts with elements of the Ukrainian security forces, most recently hurling grenades at riot police in Kiev. What we're going to do now is to review information about the support for the Uyghurs that is taking place in part of China. Now, the Uyghurs are a Turkophone group. They are ethnic. They speak the Turkish language. They are Muslim, and elements of them are not only associated with Islamists, but with elements that are associated with Al-Qaeda and other explicit terrorist offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is from the book Dollars for Terror, and this is excerpted from For the Record program number 549.
Reading now from Dollars for Terror by Richard LaBeviere, and this text and its full notation will be in the description for the Record 550. Of the independence movement in Xinjiang, we read, LaBeviere writes, China has not been spared. Xinjiang, southern China, has a population that is 55% Uyghur, a Turkophone Sunni ethnic group. It has been confronted with Islamist violence since the beginning of the 1990s. Created in 1955, Xinjiang, which means new territory, is one of the five autonomous areas of China and is the largest administrative unit of the country. The area is highly strategic at the geopolitical level. Chinese nuclear tests and rocket launches take place at the Lop Nor test grounds, as well as from an economic standpoint since it abounds in natural wealth, oil, gas, uranium, gold, etc. Against this backdrop, attacks have been proliferated by independence-seeking cliques, all preaching, quote, holy war, unquote. Some are acting in the name of Turkish identity, while others are fighting in the name of Allah, especially in the southern part of the region. As in the rest of Central Asia, in Xinjiang we are witnessing the rising influence of Wahhabi groups and the increasing proselytism of preachers from Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. By the way, this book was published in French in 1999 and in English in 2000. That's the period we're looking at here. Continuing with LaBeviere's text, traditionally allied with popular China, Pakistan is nevertheless trying to extend its influence to this part of China using the Islamists as it did in Afghanistan. For this reason, Beijing closed the road from Karakoram connecting Xinjiang to Pakistan between 1992 and 1995. Since 1996, the frequency of the incidents has skyrocketed. In February of 1997, riots exploded in Yining, a town of 300,000 inhabitants close to the west of Urumqi near the Kazakh border. This violence has caused 10 deaths, according to Chinese authorities, and the Uyghurs have counted more than 100 victims. Every week in 1998 saw a bombing or an attack with automatic weapons. The region's hotels, airports, and railway stations are in a constant state of alert. In April, Chinese authorities in the vicinity of Yining seized 700 cases of ammunition from Kazakhstan. In September, the secretary of the Xinjiang Communist Party declared that, quote, 19 training camps in which specialists returning from Afghanistan educate young recruits in the techniques of terrorism with the assistance of the Taliban, unquote, were neutralized. In January of 1999, 29 activists implicated in the February 1997 riots were arrested. On February 12th, violent clashes between the police and groups of Uyghur militants wounded several dozen people in Urumqi. 200 people were arrested. In early March, 10,000 additional soldiers arrived at Yining to beef up security, while in Beijing, the Uyghur Islamist organizations took credit for several bomb attacks. This Asian testbed is supporting the emergence of a new type of radicalism, Sunnite and ideologically conservative. It is supranational in its recruitment and in its ideology. It does not emanate out of scissions in the great Islamist organizations, but from a radicalization of the Afghan Talibans from their sanctuaries and their ties with small terrorist and mafia groups, marginalized and radicalized by repression, as in Egypt and Algeria, in a context of economic and financial globalization, as well as from the circulation of militants who have lost their territories. The principal characteristic of these networks, except in Central Asia and Egypt, is that they recruit, establish their bases, and act at the margins of the Arab Muslim world. In addition to the Egyptians, Pakistanis, Sudanese, Yemenites, and Filipinos, recently there has been a wave of immigration to Great Britain and the United States. Operations take place in Egypt, certainly in Algeria and Central Asia, but also in the east and south of Africa in Yemen, Bangladesh, New York, etc. The favorite, quote, holy wars, unquote, are Kashmir, Afghanistan, Chechnya, the Caucasus, and now China. Taking advantage of economic liberalization, many former chiefs of the holy war, unquote, have now transmuted into businessmen. They make up an Islamo-business, unquote, world that has colonies in various sectors, Islamic financial institutions, Islamic garment industries, humanitarian and benevolent organizations, private schools, and so on. As political scientist Olivier Roy says, quote, today's Islamic actors are working for liberalism and against state control, unquote. They represent a globalization of Islam deterritorialized in an approach that has been uncoupled from the Middle East. A striking westernization of Islamism is taking place, or more precisely, of the traditional infrastate networks, tribes, Quran schools, etc., are linking up with worldwide networks that function in an extremely modern way and outside the control of any state authority. This evolution results from a history that began long ago.
That again from the book Dollars for Terror, and it is about Muslim Brotherhood and allied Western intelligence and Saudi intelligence support for the Uyghurs. Now, they are an ethnic Turkish and Islamic group. Not all of them are doctrinaire Islamists or associated with terrorism. Some of them, however, some powerful elements are, and they are receiving Western support. Note also that elements of them are manifesting the corporatist economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood that we looked at in For the Record 862. Now, in a number of For the Record programs, For the Record, actually AFA number 14, AFA number 21, and other shows dealing with the shooting of Pope John Paul II in May of 1981, we took a look at the National Action Party of Turkey and its youth wing, the Grey Wolves, the most famous alumnus of the Grey Wolves as Mehmet Ali Agha, who shot Pope John Paul II. The National Action Party is an explicit fascist and a nationalist and pan-Turkist party. Now, we've spoken about that, and please use the website for more information about that. I would note that now the Grey Wolves are supporting the Uyghurs. In fact, they are very active in Turkey, agitating against Chinese and, to an extent, terrorizing Chinese in Turkey, and this on behalf of the Uyghurs. Yahoo News features an article from Business Insider from July 21st of 2015. It's by Barbara Tash, T-A-S-C-H. Anti-China sentiment is suddenly sweeping over Turkey. And after describing some of the violent protests, we read, the protests gathered momentum a few weeks ago when reports emerged that Uyghurs who share ethnicity and have close cultural ties with Turkish Muslims who were living in regions of Western China had allegedly not been allowed to fast during the holy month of Ramadan, skipping down. In a recent interview, Devleti Bahçeli, B-A-H-C-E-L-I, chairman of the far-right Nationalist Action Party, or MHP, whose members have been accused of assaulting tourists, said they are, quote, sensitive to injustices in China. And I would note here that elements of the Grey Wolves have been terrorizing, or this is said they have been mobilizing against Chinese in Turkey. Now, again, we have been talking about the Uyghurs and their associations with the Islamists and their associations with others. What we're going to do now is to go through, for the record, 549, and we're going to see how the Uyghurs and the Pan-Turkists ally with, on the one hand, the UNPO, headed up by Karl von Habsburg, and also the Dalai Lama Foundation as well. So we have in the person of Erkin Alptekin, E-R-K-I-N-A-L-P-T-E-K-I-N, an individual who bridges from the Muslim Brotherhood to the Pan-Turkist movement and the Grey Wolves to the Dalai Lama through the milieu of the Habsburg. This from, for the record, 549.
The aforementioned Erkin Alptekin, the son, by the way, of İsa Yusuf Alptekin, for whom numerous municipal places in Istanbul are named, is a key functionary of the Pan-Turkist movement. He is also, as we looked at in For the Record 548, and as we will review right now, a member of the board of directors, a key member of the board of directors of the Dalai Lama Foundation. From the Dalai Lama Foundation's website, Erkin Alptekin is described as follows. Erkin Alptekin is one of the foremost human rights advocates for the Uyghur people of eastern Turkestan, known as the Xinjiang Autonomous Region of the People's Republic of China. Mr. Alptekin was employed by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty from 1971 to 1994. He is one of the founders of the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, UNPO, and currently serves as its General Secretary. Another key member of the Dalai Lama Foundation is Michael Van Walt. Michael Van Walt currently serves as Executive President of the Peace Action Council and Legal Advisor to the Office of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. From 1991 to 1998, Dr. Van Walt was General Secretary of UNPO, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization. Dr. Van Walt holds law degrees from Europe and America and is currently Adjunct Professor of International Law, Golden Gate University School of Law, San Francisco. Yet another UNPO functionary or official on the board of the Dalai Lama Foundation.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing in, but by no means exclusively, economic and financial matters.
Now, we're going to very quickly review some information from past broadcasts from the South Asia Analysis Group paper number 499 titled The U.S. and Terrorism in Xinjiang, authored by B. Rama from July of 2002. This is in the descriptions for both For the Record 540, but it is in the description for 547, which will soon be up, and will be in the description for 548. We see the following about Erich Inalp Tekin and the Dalai Lama's milieu. And this is not from the bizarro world of the Bush administration, but rather from elements associated with Indian intelligence. And I want to note here, too, that one of the interesting aspects of the Bush administration is that it appears that at times, and this is one of them, they've actually, by mistake, gotten something right. Indeed, it appears very much as though elements of the East Turkestan independence movement, or liberation, unquote, movement, are associated with terrorism, and beyond that, fascism, and the Dalai Lama himself is part of this milieu. Again, whatever goes on between the man's ears, and I wouldn't hesitate to guess at that. Reviewing from this B. Rahman paper from the South Asia Analysis Group, not part of the Bush bizarro world, India should have reasons to be concerned over the Dalai Lama's hobnobbing with the pan-Islamic elements in Xinjiang. One cannot avoid suspecting that the influence of these elements must have been behind his participation in a conference organized in Chennai last year by some elements which have been acting as apologists for General Pervez Musharraf, the Pakistani military dictator, which was attended by a representative of the Hurriyat of J&K and a large number of Pakistanis, some of them retired Pakistan military officers. The Dalai Lama's setup subsequently denied or played down some of the controversial remarks attributed to him at the conference. The government of India should consider conveying to the Dalai Lama its unhappiness and concern over his association with pan-Islamic elements in Xinjiang. Now, other elements of this paper that we looked at in For the Record 547 and 548 have specifically identified elements of the Islamist Uyghur movement as associated with the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda milieu. Now, there are other elements as well. Noting here, again from this paper, just as in J&K, in Xinjiang too, there are two distinct terrorist extremist movements, one resorting to violence on ethnic grounds to assert the Uyghur ethnic identity against the perceived Han Chinese domination, and the other using religious and pan-Islamic elements to justify violence for the establishment of an independent Islamic state. While the ethnic separatist elements have been the beneficiaries of sympathy and support from the Dalai Lama's setup and the Tibetan diaspora abroad, as well as the U.S., Taiwanese, and Turkish intelligence services, the religious fundamentalist elements have been in receipt of support from the Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI-backed jihadi organizations in Pakistan, the Taliban, and bin Laden's International Islamic Front for Jihad against the USA in Israel. In the 1970s and the 1980s, the Central Intelligence Agency of the USA had built up a network of contacts with the Uyghur separatist elements, and some of those who had in the past worked for the Munich-based Radio Liberty of the CIA, such as Erich Inalp Tekin, chairman of the Europe-based East Turkestani Union and a close Uyghur associate of the Dalai Lama, are now in the forefront of the ethnic separatist movement.
Now, again, it may seem like a long way from home to see a pan-Turkist and potential Islamist associated with Western intelligence, the milieu of the Habsburgs, and the Dalai Lama. That really is not such a reach. What we're going to do now is to excerpt For the Record program number 842, the fifth interview that I did with Peter Lavenda about his brilliant book, The Hitler Legacy. And what we're talking about here is the Dalai Lama, who I guess one could say is not as advertised.
This is one of those things that I was not prepared to find when I found it. And I came across it when I was researching on Holy Alliance the first time. That was back in the 90s. And I had come across a documentation at the National Archives that showed that the Nazis, or the SS in particular, had financed an expedition to Tibet in 1938. I thought this was one of those things that you read about in these speculative fiction books, you know, sort of the Tibetan connection to the Nazis and stuff. I didn't realize it actually happened until I had done the research, and I was startled, I mean, by this idea. I couldn't get my head around it. I read the newspaper reports that were published at the time, saying the first white men in Lhasa, for instance, some of the newspaper articles, which was not exactly true, but it was close. And what I did is I then went to the Tibet House in New York City. Tibet House is a series of places around the country, around the world, run to promote, you know, Tibetan ideas, Tibetan religion, Tibetan politics, you know, part of the Dalai Lama's operation, financed by people like Richard Gere and Robert Thurman and people of that nature, very prominent Hollywood celebrity types, and et cetera, which I only found out while I was researching the Hitler legacy that Tibet House was actually a CIA front, among other things. But at the time, I did not know this when I was researching Unholy Alliance, and I found video footage. There's documentary footage. There's photographs. There's a lot of documentation on this particular expedition. And the expedition was run by a man called Ernst Schaefer, who was a very well-known anthropologist. He had been to the United States. He had lectured in various places before the war, of course. He was a respected author of books on Central Asia, for instance, sort of like a Sven Hedin of Sweden. He was that kind of an explorer, you know, kind of an adventurer type. And he was leading the expedition to Tibet in 1938 with SS flags and swastika armbands and all the whole thing. And among his retinue was Bruno Daguerre, as you mentioned, and a few others. They were measuring the skulls of Tibetans, crania, to see, you know, if there's, to see what the racial makeup, the ethnic origins might be of the Tibetans, the idea that maybe the Tibetans were the lost race, the origin of the Aryan people, which was kind of a Himmler concept, one of his fantasies, was that Tibet was the origin, you know, a place of mystical power and genetic purity. It was still a kind of a feudal monarchy. All of these things appealed to Himmler. Plus, of course, there was the idea that they had, you know, hidden scriptures and sacred texts and sacred objects, very Indiana Jones. They were going to take all of this stuff back with them and see how that could be used in the interests of the Reich. So this expedition took place in 38. At that point, the Dalai Lama, I think, was still a child. I don't believe he met any of these individuals at that time, but the story would develop a bit later. So during the war, 38 is when pretty much just before the war broke out. In 39, the war was in full flower. And all of these members of the Tibet expedition, the SS expedition, were back in Germany. And they were back at work in fields that would have been more conducive to whatever the war effort might have been. In the case of Bruno Daguerre, this is the thing that astonished me mostly, I think. It opened my mind to the possibility that a lot of the New Age information that we're given all the time about Tibet and about the mysterious East, all this Orientalist kind of fantasy, might have a big hole in it. And that's when we discovered that Bruno Daguerre, the SS man who was out there measuring crania among the Tibetans for ethnographic studies or whatever, was now back in Germany deciding he was going to create a museum of human beings. And he was going to show the progress, the different kinds of races. And in order to do this, he needed specimens. And he went to a concentration camp. He looked at the living specimens that were there, human beings, pointed to the ones he wanted, had them murdered, and had the skeletal material, or had actually all the bodies shipped to him for defleshing so that he could make sure that he would have perfect skeletal material to show in his museum. He was responsible for the deaths of over 80 individuals from the concentration camps. This was a man who had been to Tibet, who had attended religious ceremonies there, had gone to the Buddhist temples, you know, had spent a lot of time there, came back and committed murderous atrocities, for which he spent, I think, not more than about 2 years altogether in prison. And then later in his life, considered himself a friend of Tibet, actually wrote letters to the Dalai Lama's organization in Dharamsala in northern India, which were published at one point on their website, I believe they've since been taken down, talking about his fond memories of Tibet. There's photographs of the Dalai Lama with Bruno Daguerre, a man who was a war criminal responsible for murder. I mean, for war crimes, unbelievable war crimes, picking out human beings as specimens for a museum. This is something you might hear about in a horror film. And yet here was Daguerre actually doing it and proud of having done it.
And networking with the Dalai Lama decades afterward.
Yes.
There was a movie in the late 90s starring Brad Pitt as a guy named Heinrich Harrer, last name H-A-R-R-E-R. He too was SS, and he was more deeply involved with the Dalai Lama. Tell us about Heinrich Harrer and perhaps the difference between the celluloid Heinrich Harrer as portrayed by Brad Pitt and the remarkable covert reality of Heinrich Harrer as you have set it forth in the Hitler legacy.
Well, I've been fascinated by Harrer for a long time. I have, I think, a first edition of his book, 7 Years in Tibet, that I read years and years ago, and was not aware of the entire story at the time. Of course, nobody was. Harrer was a mountaineer. He became famous as a mountain climber, one of these very aggressive physical guys, an Austrian, had his picture taken with Hitler, with members of his team, his mountaineering team, had photographs taken with Heinrich Himmler at a dinner. Harrer was a golden boy of the Third Reich, showing what remarkable specimens the SS was producing. So here was a young, blonde SS officer who then is captured behind enemy lines in India. The story, the cover story, is he was going mountaineering again. He was going to climb some kind of mountain in the border between India and Tibet, and was captured by the British when the war broke out, spent some time in a prison camp, and eventually he and a friend, Peter Auschneider, they escaped from the prisoner of war camp and made their way mostly by foot through the mountains, across the passes, and into Tibet, where, to make a long story short, Heinrich Harrer became a kind of tutor to the young Dalai Lama, who's sort of a pubescent teen at this point, and he becomes the tutor to the Dalai Lama. He's befriended by the Dalai Lama. He introduces the Dalai Lama to the Western world in general, to radio, to movies, to all sorts of things that the Dalai Lama would not ordinarily have been introduced to, and here's a guy who's telling him all about this and, you know, telling him all of these stories. That's the pleasant story that we're given in Heinrich Harrer's book, in which he makes no mention of the fact that he was a member of the SS. And not only, as we find out later, was he a member of the SS, he was also a member of the SA, of the Sturmabteilung, the stormtroopers. This was a devoted Nazi, an Austrian Nazi. Austria has given us some of the most virulent Nazis, more than Germany. Of course, Austria gave us Hitler. Austria is the country where you find a lot of the very, very doctrinaire, very ideological Nazis coming from, and Harrer was no exception. Harrer was a devoted Nazi. He downplayed it, of course, saying that he only joined the SS because he had to, in order to do what he wanted to do, in order to, you know, to go on these trips and go on these journeys and stuff. It was like a business decision, basically, according to Harrer, until his SS dossier came to light, and we discover he was not only in the SS, he was also in the SA, he was a member of the Nazi Party. I believe he joined the Nazi Party when it was still illegal in Austria to do so. This was a man who was a Nazi, there's no question about it. So we have to put that to rest right now. He was not an innocent who just had to be, you know, had to join the SS. The way Wernher von Braun says the same thing, you know, oh, I had to join the SS because you had to in order to work at this factory or something, which was nonsense. So here's Harrer with the Dalai Lama. He's there right up until the point of the Chinese invasion. We have CIA going up into Tibet to try to cut deals and try to figure out how they're going to help the Dalai Lama to escape. There's all sorts of secret meetings taking place. The reports have been published. They're now documented. At the time that the CIA is meeting with the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama's representatives, his associates, his brothers, and some of the other people in the government, Heinrich Harrer is there. He's still there. He had to have known what was going on. According to Harrer, he was an intimate of the palace. He knew everything that was going on. If white people started showing up in Lhasa, he would be the first to know about it. He never talks about this, never discusses it. Slowly, as more and more information comes out, and he's written other books since then, before his death a few years ago, people began uncovering more and more of the Harrer background and discovering that he was very involved with American intelligence, at least, if not with other intelligence agencies also. He was spying, and he was an anti-communist, and let's face it, so's the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama's country was invaded by communist China. The Dalai Lama has a very anti-communist, of course, perspective on these things, as he should. He was the leader of the country, both politically and spiritually. One of the few left who could claim that kind of leadership role. So I'm not taking it away from the Dalai Lama by saying that he was an anti-communist. But being an anti-communist, the problem is it gives you strange bedfellows, as it does in the United States, as it does anywhere else. Becoming anti-communist is almost a magnet for the extreme right, for pro-Nazis, for fascists of various kinds. There's almost no way out of it. It's very hard to take the middle path and have a high moral ground and saying, well, I'm anti-communist and I'm anti-Nazi at the same time. It's easier to be one or the other. Many of our American politicians have been sacrificed because they wanted to walk the middle path and a plague on both your houses. But as it turned out, it's very difficult to do that. The Dalai Lama is no exception. We don't see him photographs with leftists, for instance. We don't see him taking photographs with communist leaders. The Dalai Lama's photographs are with right-wing types, with Nazis, with Bruno Beger, with Heinrich Harrer, with Miguel Serrano of Chile, a rabid Nazi ideologue who was an ambassador to India at the time the Dalai Lama was living in India. He's surrounded by people who are from the extreme fascist Nazi background. And his position is, of course, anti-communist as well. And, you know, a Tibetan military group was raised under the Dalai Lama, trained by the CIA to go and fight the communists. So they were funded, they were given guns, they were given training. Not enough guns, not enough training, not enough money, because the CIA didn't want to cause an actual war with China. But they were looking at giving China a bit of a stomach ache by funding a Tibetan expeditionary force to go and fight against them. So this was all part of the deal. The Dalai Lama had to know that the kind of funding he was getting from CIA was not going to liberate his country, that it was just simply a drop in the bucket for cosmetic purposes and to bother the Chinese, but not really to upset them too much. So part of the whole geopolitical structure around the Dalai Lama is extremely suspect.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site also features many articles not included in programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
You point out that Heinrich Harrer, again, like so many SS officers, was working on covert ops for American intel, again.
Well, yes. I mean, the suspicion started when he wrote a book about a trip that he took to Papua New Guinea. So talking about I Come from the Stone Age, I think was the title of the book, if I'm not mistaken. And I read the book. I went through it, and it's a very strange book compared to 7 Years in Tibet. It's very low on detail, particularly considering that he was in Papua New Guinea at a time when the Dutch were on the verge of losing that territory. He was in there at a very peculiar time and says almost nothing about it, virtually discusses very little about it, discusses very little about some of the people that he met and some of the places that he was. It looked as though it was a cover story for something. And this was picked up by reviewers with background in anthropology, in archaeology, in ethnography, who read the book and said, what is he talking about? You know, it looked very much as if it had been a government-sponsored text, as if some government somewhere had just sent him there to write this thing, and it had nothing to do with anything in particular. It was not one of his more successful books, but the suspicion was brought out at that point that maybe he was an intelligence operative. And yes, as late as the 1960s at least, and the 1970s, the early 1970s, from what I can understand, Harrer was in the employ, or if not in the employ financially, somehow collaborating with Western intelligence services. I think there's, at this point, no doubt about it. It's the only explanation that makes sense.
And from For the Record 843, more about the Dalai Lama. This, again, from an interview with Peter Lavenda about the book, The Hitler Legacy.
Certainly. Of course, the Dalai Lama, until recently, when he stepped down from his political post, was simultaneously the political leader and the spiritual leader of the country. Tibet was arranged along feudal lines. It was a kingdom that was closed off to the rest of the world. It was preserving its own, you might say, its own racial purity by being that cut off. It wasn't merely cut off because of its location, but it was a deliberate position that Tibet took regarding the rest of the world. So there was some similarity in this idea of a race that was separate, a religion that had, we might say, apocalyptic overtones. The basic text that the Dalai Lama represents, especially in the many initiations that he's conducted around the world since the 1950s, is that of the Kala Chakra Tantra. And the Kala Chakra Tantra is a very interesting text. It is more than just a religious initiatory program. There is more to the Kala Chakra Tantra than that, including a section on what would happen at the end of the world. The Kala Chakra Tantra speaks of the Kalki, speaks of a king that would come out of Shambhala. Shambhala or Shambhala is the hidden kingdom, the mysterious, invisible kingdom, sort of a garden of the immortals, if you talk about it in Chinese terms. It's located somewhere and nowhere. Only the pure of heart can see it or enter it, according to the legends. But the Kalki at the end times, you might say, will come out of Shambhala with an enormous army, and they will put to the sword all the unbelievers. The idea that there would be a Buddhist king that would be so vicious is something that probably many listeners would find appalling, since Buddhism is, at least allegedly, it's a religion of nonviolence, it's a religion of peace, definitely not a religion of war. And yet this idea of a worldwide conflagration, an apocalyptic battle at the end times, seems very alien to Buddhism, and yet there it is in the heart of this particular tantra. This belief was so strong that it permeated not only a lot of Tibetan culture, but it colored relations with other countries as well. To a certain extent, we saw how, for instance, in India, it had been a British colony, as we know, until the 1940s. There was a Indian nationalist movement among the Hindu believers as opposed to the Buddhists. In Buddhism, there's very few Buddhists left in India, but in terms of what they called Hindutva, a kind of Indian nationalist movement, rose up to join forces with potentially Hitler. Had Hitler managed to cross the Suez Canal, the leader of that movement, Subhas Chandra Bose, saw Hitler as the Kalki, saw Hitler as this leader who would come out and purify the world and get rid of all of the unbelievers. There was this idea that there's a connection between this idea of Shambhala, the mystical hidden kingdom of the Kalachakra Tantra, and the Tula, the mystical kingdom of the Nazis, of the Aryan mythology, this Teutonic paradise from which the Aryan race had descended. These ideas were so consonant with each other that the Tibet expedition of 1938 was sponsored by the SS to send SS officers, scientists, into Tibet to make contact with Tibet and also to survey the country, try to find out if any of these rumors might be true, if there was any ethnographic evidence to show that, you know, the Tibetans, for instance, descended from Tula, that the Tibetans were Aryans. All of the cranial measurements were being taken. All sorts of other information was being gathered by these SS officers there in Tibet in 38, 39. Because there was a lot of belief that these people had a lot in common. The Tibetans might have been the source for the Aryan race. The Aryans may have descended first to the Himalayas, to this kingdom in the midst of the mountains, and then spread out from there across the rest of the world at some point in ancient prehistory. So there are these ideas that the Dalai Lama represented a bastion of resistance against communism, the way that the Nazis, of course, saw themselves as resisting communism in Europe. Tibet was going to resist communism from its place in Asia. Remember that in Asia there was very little resistance to communism. There was a large socialist movement taking place in India, as well as a nationalist one. The Japanese, of course, were extremely nationalist. The Chinese now were developing a communist movement. So having Tibet there seemed like it was a religious and political counterpoint to the rise of communism in Asia. We tend to forget that when the West was talking about a Cold War and about the threat of communism, that it wasn't only the threat of communism from Russia, but there was a threat in Asia of communism from China at the same time. And Tibet was essentially the answer to some observers to resisting Chinese hegemony in the region. So you had the CIA eventually in the early 1950s deciding it was going to help train Tibetan guerrillas. Many of them were trained in the United States in the state of Colorado. They were trained in sabotage and guerrilla warfare and sent back into Tibet to conduct operations against the Chinese communists from there. The Dalai Lama was promised all of this support if he would become vocal in his opposition to communism, which was not difficult. The idea was the Dalai Lama had such spiritual presence and such spiritual credibility that he could convince Buddhists and non-Buddhists alike in Asia to rise up against the communist threat, not only in China, but in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and other regions. So this was an Asian version of what the Americans and the British intelligence were doing with Nazis in Europe to fight the Soviet Union. They were using Tibetan spiritual leaders like the Dalai Lama, but also Tibetan guerrilla forces to fight communism in Asia. And it was believed that there was a lot in common. We have many photographs showing the Dalai Lama with such war criminals, basically, as Bruno Bega, whom we mentioned, an anthropologist who was on the SS Tibet expedition of 1938, who always spoke and wrote fondly of his time in Tibet, but who was himself a war criminal responsible for the deaths of over 80 prisoners in the camps that he was selecting for his collection of human skeletal material for a museum showing various human racial types and ethnographic types. Here was a person who, you know, was a war criminal without any doubt, and yet he was a friend of the Dalai Lama and was shown in photographs with him on numerous occasions, as was Heinrich Harrer, of course, whom we mentioned previously as well, the famous mountain climber who became a tutor to the young Dalai Lama and who was also involved in espionage activity in Tibet and then later in other parts of the world for Western governments against communists. The list is very long. There's a kind of strange association between the leader of Tibet, leader of Tibetan Buddhism, and various Nazis. There is no such relationship that I could find between the Dalai Lama and, let's say, left-wing socialist type leaders or anything like that. The relationship seems to be forged with those of the right. It may be because of the Dalai Lama's obvious stand against communism, because his country was invaded by China in 1950, and then again he had to flee in the later 50s to get into northern India, from where he's since set up his operation. So we're talking about a man who is at the same time political and spiritual leader of his people. Without putting too fine a point on it, of course, this was Hitler's relationship to Germany, his relationship to the Third Reich. He was the political leader, obviously, the military leader as well. And at the same time, he represented an ideology that was striving for purity, for anti-communism, of course, anti-Semitism, and struggling to maintain a kind of ideological and racial purity for his people. He was a figurehead that way.
Again, those last two excerpts from the book The Hitler Legacy and from the interviews with Peter Lavenda. Well, again, I can appreciate that it may seem a hell of a reach to go from Al-Qaeda to the Pan-Turkists to the Dalai Lama to the milieu of the Habsburgs to the OUNB to the Chechens. It really is not such a reach. What we are looking at are the elements that are being used for the ongoing offensive in the Earth Island or World Island. I'm going to conclude by taking a look at Paula Dobriansky from the U.S. Department of State Archive, Undersecretary for Democracy and Global Affairs. Since her appointment in 2001 by President George W. Bush, Undersecretary Dobriansky has also served concurrently as the Special Coordinator for Tibetan Issues. In this capacity, she is the U.S. government's point person on Tibet policy matters. And Paula Dobriansky is the daughter of a top OUNB operative, Lev Dobriansky, who was Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas and whose name crops up in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. In Salon.com of February 25th of 2014, is the U.S. backing neo-Nazis in Ukraine by Max Blumenthal, and we read, in Washington, the OUNB reconstituted under the banner of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, or UCCA, an umbrella organization comprised of complete OUNB fronts, according to author Russ Ballant. By the mid-1980s, the Reagan administration was honeycombed with UCCA members, with the group's chairman, Lev Dobriansky, serving as ambassador to the Bahamas, and his daughter, Paula, sitting on the National Security Council, then later heading up the Tibet desk at the State Department. To get a full grasp on this, and I can appreciate that this is an awfully large glass of water to drink at one sitting, please use the descriptions for the programs, for the record, 862 and 863 in particular. This concludes For the Record 863, 9/11, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Earth Island Boogie Part 2, being recorded on September 13th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.